Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking.
Wow!
What was that all about, huh? If you're listening to this, it means you survived the year 2020. Achievement unlocked. I hope that you are well, and I hope that you're optimistic, like I am, that better things are in store for us this year and as things go forward. Welcome to the sixth season of Enterprising Individuals. We were gone a little longer than I had planned for various reasons, both related and not to 2020 business, but we have returned for an all-new year of shows examining in excruciating detail the Star Trek universe. Six seasons, believe it or not, but here we are. When the show started, I was just thinking about how to actually make it, and when it was rolling along, I was mostly focused on keeping it going, but as recently as the fourth season, I began thinking about how the show would eventually end. In fact, every season past the third, the show has had a non-zero chance of wrapping it all up and coming to an end. A small chance, certainly, but it's been on my mind. And as far as the material that we're talking about, we could obviously go on just about forever, but I've been wondering if there's enough ways to say things differently or to look at things from a new perspective, and if it's just possible that the work will at some point be done and it'll be time to tune out. We're not there yet, but with that in mind, we're always trying to grow the show and evolve it past what it's been in the past. And to that end, we'll be trying a few new things this year and trying to expand the scope of the episodes and topics that we're exploring. One of the things that was important to me in putting the show together initially was that it have a firm but not unyielding structure to it. There's a lot of podcasts about media that are just two or more people talking about something, and that's fine. But for something like Trek that has such a repeatable structure in its presentation, I wanted to make sure that our discussions about it had a similar structure. But long, boring story short, I'm going to do my best to break out of some of the structures that I've leaned on in years past on the show, hopefully to the effect of having more rewarding discussions about our various Trek episodes. We're going to continue this year on our supplemental episodes examining the social issues present in Trek stories because I think it's both rewarding and extremely relevant to our world today. A common refrain for me on the show, arguably a catchphrase for me, is that the utopia of Trek is great, but Trek sure isn't a blueprint or a roadmap for reaching that utopia. But I guess I want to challenge that assumption, because in a lot of ways, I think it maybe really is that easy. Being nice to people, respecting their differences, being selfless, and looking out for others, and replicators maybe is actually how we conquer a lot of our problems and we make it to the stars. I don't know, but we're going to examine that more this year. I also want to make an effort this year to dig into both the history and the structure of Trek itself, examine how it was put together originally, how future generations stayed loyal to its structure or pushed to change it, both from the perspective of it being an ongoing work of fiction, but also a weekly production. Well, you know, what are the qualities and the techniques that has made Trek so continually successful on TV and in film? You know, that kind of stuff. And to that end, I have a guest today who can speak to all of those ideas and more. Darren Mooney of The Escapist Magazine is with me on the show today. I was really excited to get a chance to talk with Darren about Star Trek, not only because he's a thoughtful and gregarious person, but he's also someone who has been exegizing media for many years. I myself have often consulted him as a resource when preparing for this show, specifically his site movieblog.com. The first O in movie is a zero, and his analysis on his site is comprehensive and examines the exact kinds of things that I was talking about earlier, the structures and themes of the franchise and of media, and I had a great time talking with him. We'll get right to that, but first, I wanted to remind you that you can always find us on social media at Enterprising Individuals or at EISTPOD on Twitter. We've got a network Discord where we're always talking about this show and other shows on the network, plus pop culture topics, movies, TV and film, and more. It's free. Join us. There's a link in the show notes that will take you there. Also, if you want to support the show, become a member of our crew by going to patreon.com/EISTpod and signing up. We're reorganizing the Patreon a little bit this year. As I've gotten better, I hope, at finding things to offer you as a patron, we've changed some of our content. So if you've been a patron in the past, or you've thought about joining up but haven't yet, check out patreon.com/EISTpod and see what we've got on offer. We've got extended discussions from guests, and we've got outtakes from the show, also special features and commentary tracks and more. Go to patreon.com/EISTpod and join our crew today. Enough of my yapping. Enjoy my talk with Darren Mooney. Here's to a great 2021 and beyond. And with that, let's get underway. Hailing frequencies open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and if you thought we'd start this year without a joke about the area of penetration being sensitive, do you even listen to this show? I'm joined on this episode by Darren Mooney. Darren is a columnist and film critic for The Escapist magazine. He's also the co-host of the 250 podcast, a look at the IMDb Top 250. He's also an author. His latest book, Christopher Nolan, A Critical Study of the Films, tracks Nolan's career from film student to Oscar-nominated auteur. Darren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. When you say it like that, it makes it sound like I've actually done stuff.
You've accomplished something, of course. Permission to come aboard granted. Today we'll be talking about The Immunity Syndrome, the 18th or 19th episode of the second season of Star Trek, the original series, depending on how you're keeping count. When Star Trek returned to screens in the fall of 1987, its creator Gene Roddenberry had changed his ideas about how the characters of the future would relate to each other. As his vision evolved from the optimistic 23rd century into the egalitarian 24th, he was determined that the crew of the USS Enterprise-D would suffer no interpersonal conflicts, that their enlightened society had mended all fences among Federation races, and the need for arbitration, lawyers, and presumably marriage counselors would be obviated. Cue two seasons of bloodless, dispassionate TNG episodes written by overly frustrated screenwriters who wrestled with plot and circumstance to inject drama into their pacified world. The Trek franchise would eventually relent on the no-conflict rule in future installments. Series like DS9 and Voyager, both set outside of the boundaries of the Federation, were much more comfortable allowing characters and their personal convictions to create the natural human dissension that is the lifeblood of TV drama. But the franchise could have looked inward rather than outward for the solution, as the original series and its trinity of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy had already provided sci-fi's primordial id, ego, and superego, and delivered enough interpersonal conflict to power the franchise for 50 years and beyond. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Darren, it's great to have you on board, and I always ask first-time guests to the show how they first discovered Star Trek. How did you become a Star Trek fan?
So I had a rather kind of complicated childhood, much like everybody else did. But as a child, I moved around a lot. I was born in Ireland in the late 80s, which was not a good time economically to have been born in Ireland. My dad had to move abroad to find jobs and to work, and we had to move with him. And obviously that meant leaving family behind. And I think anybody who has had a relative or a grandparent or an aunt and uncle overseas will be familiar with the care packages that you receive. Sometimes it includes things like, say, for an Irish person, rashers and sausages are kind of like internationally smuggled across waters, stuffed away inside of cabins. But for me, as a kid, it involved VHS recordings of basically shows taken off television. And several of those shows were, you know, what you might expect for a young kid, shows like, say, Captain Planet, shows like Batman the Animated Series, which was a fantastic kind of, you know, eye-opening experience for me. But also Star Trek The Next Generation, because my grandparents were huge fans of The Next Generation. I kind of watched it through them. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, when you have that memory of being a kid watching a show, but watching it in a way that's kind of out of sequence, because obviously in Ireland, we had Sky One, which would show the show at kind of like 5 o'clock during the day in syndication, much like many people kind of became aware of the original series kind of during the 70s and 80s. And I remember in particular, like frequently getting in that situation that anybody, any child of that generation will remember, but which is impossible now in the era of Netflix, of being in a situation where you watch the first part of a two-parter and then have to wait 5 years to see the second part, the resolution of it. Right. And it's great because I remember like explicitly it being Gambit Part 1. Watching that on TV on a Monday night or a Sunday night on kind of Sky One, and then hopping on a plane to Ghana the following day because the Christmas break was over, and never seeing the second part of Gambit for the next 5 or 6 years. Now, you can argue that that might have been the best way to watch Gambit. I'm not going to disagree with that. But that was kind of like my experience of kind of seeing Star Trek as a kid. And then, obviously, latching onto it. And as with anybody else who latches onto a franchise, you have parts of it that you share with your extended family. So Star Trek The Next Generation would be my grandparents' favorite Star Trek. It would be my mother's favorite Star Trek. In fact, I have, again, a story that probably sounds much more traumatic than it actually was, which I remember one of my birthday parties involved my mother sneaking off early to see Star Trek First Contact in the cinema. Which is great, because it's good to know that you're loved almost as much as Star Trek First Contact.
Right.
She went to an early screening so she could be back for the bulk of the party. But also, like outside of that, then obviously you have the parts that you share, like The Next Generation, but you have the parts that are yours. And I was perfectly of age for Star Trek Deep Space Nine to be mine, because again, this is something that anybody who lived through the era will recall. And even if you haven't lived through the era, there are still echoes of it in the way that it's talked about, particularly by, say, performers from the other Star Trek shows, or sort of if you look at things like the message boards, where Deep Space Nine, when it arrived, was seen as being a very odd little show in terms of the Star Trek canon. Sure. As you pointed out there a moment ago, it had more conflict than The Next Generation did. You know, the joke about it being a show about boldly sitting, which yes. got very old very quickly, but didn't stop people from telling it. The fact that it was more character-driven, the fact that it was darker, the fact that it was more dialogue-driven, arguably, than even The Next Generation. All kind of came into play. But as a teenager, I found it and it became my Star Trek show, because I remember buying the VHSs. And again, this is an old experience, because again, being in Ireland and not in the US, we didn't watch it on television. It arrived on television 6 or 8 months later, and I was damned if I was going to wait for that. Sure. So I used to have like a little kind of store where I go down, and once every 2 or 3 weeks, I'd buy a VHS, and it would have 2 episodes on it, and I'd watch them back to back, and I'd watch them over and over again until the tape kind of wore down on them.
Right.
And that was kind of how I consumed Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine was one of the first shows that I really watched from beginning to end as a teenager, as a kid, which is a great show to do that way, because it was really the first Star Trek where you arguably benefited from doing that. I mean I know that The Next Generation has arcs, like, you know, the Klingon High Council stuff. I know The Next Generation has kind of stories and character development as it goes, like Riker's arc as he grows across the seasons is remarkable, but I think that Deep Space Nine was really the first Star Trek show where if you watched it from beginning to end, you got a real bonus effect, as opposed to watching it in syndication out of order. So that's kind of like the long story of me kind of going to Star Trek. And, you know, again, I kind of watched along with it. After Deep Space Nine ended, I kind of drifted a little bit out. Part of it was because I got older. Part of it was because I maybe didn't connect with Voyager in the same way. And I know that a lot of people love Voyager. And I know that Voyager's had a big resurgence on Netflix. I think that's great, in large part because Voyager is a show that arguably benefits from Netflix, where it's just like, I want to binge a lot of these episodes right now, and I can watch them any order I want. And I think that's remarkable and worth celebrating. But for me, that didn't really click. And then kind of Enterprise came around, and I'd gone to college. And I remember, like, actually... And it's weird to say that you remember this, but I kind of drifted away from the show in its second season. I just kind of stopped watching it live. It just kind of stopped being a priority for me. And then years later, I remember coming back to it. And I came back to it for my blog, which is the movie blog, which is this little blog that I set up back in 2009 because my other half got sick and tired of hearing me talk about movies and TV all the time and thought it would be more constructive if I were to just vent into space randomly. And, I think that was a very constructive piece of advice that they gave me, and I agree entirely. It helped our relationship a great deal, and it also, I think, gave me a forum where I could rant at kind of like length about these things that I love. And as part of that, I went back and I rewatched pretty much all of the Star Trek franchise, all of TOS, most about half of TNG, all DS9, all of Voyager, all of Enterprise. And I remember kind of jumping back in and kind of re-immersing myself in it and kind of loving it and kind of soaking in and kind of just absorbing it. And again, it feels really bad that I gave up on Enterprise in the second season, because I would argue that the third and fourth seasons of Enterprise are an underrated franchise highlight. I think they don't get enough respect or enough love from the franchise or from the fans at large. Yeah. I think they're remarkable pieces of television. So that is the very, very long and winding answer of my kind of relationship to Star Trek.
So you mentioned your website, the movie blog, and I should say that the Owen movie is a zero.
Yes, because I didn't get in there quick enough. I wasn't part of the .com.
There is another movie blog. Yeah,
yeah, much bigger, better movie blog.
Look for Terrans if you're online. And you write reviews and commentary on film and TV. And I have to confess that the movie blog is a frequent stop for me when researching and preparing for episodes of this show. Your takes are very insightful and they're well-researched. And for me, often instead of just, you know, cracking open These Are the Voyages or whatever, I'll just think, what did Darren say about this episode? What sources was he looking at when I'm preparing for my episodes? So if nothing else, thanks for providing such a great resource for fans and for this show in particular.
Thank you. I'm really glad that people actually seem to enjoy it, which is very flattering. Because again, it's largely just me shouting into the void. It was very much me driving my partner slowly insane. When she's just like, she was like, hey, I just like horny Spock. He looks sexy. It's like, yeah, but have you thought about what it actually means? Like, no, I don't want to do that. That's fine.
I saw a post with somebody had a picture of Saru with his shirt off. I think it was for one of the earlier Discovery episodes where he doesn't have his top on. And he's got the whole, he's cut, but he's like alien cut because it's all these like ridges. And somebody's like, does anybody else think Saru is sexy? And the responses were like, no, cool character though.
Somebody out there, Saru is exactly what they're looking for, I think.
Kelpo sapien.
Yeah, I mean, think of the things anyway, or don't think of the things, never mind. But now, and I mean, again, like, not to jump too far into the discussion that we're going to have here, but it's worth noting that, like, the original sex symbol on Star Trek, as much as we joke about it being kind of Kirk and Kirk having a girl in every port, the episode that we're talking about today is in the second season. That doesn't really kick off until the third season when you see, like, Fred Freeberger coming in and he's basically like, oh, no, we're going to make Kirk a traditional romantic lead. We're going to have him, like, turn into this weird Native American character and have a wife. We're going to have him, like, you know, seduce this kind of like Orion slave girl in this mental institution that's gone completely wrong. We're going to have him wrestle with this kind of rebellion leading woman in this mining camp on a bed for some reason, and all that sort of, like, or like he's going to like fall in love with a woman whose tears drive him mad with lust. All that stuff was kind of yet to come in terms of like treating Kirk as a proper sex symbol. But like in the early seasons, it was really kind of Spock that people latched on to, because obviously you have like the fanzine like Spockanalia, for example. You had him becoming kind of a counterculture icon. You had a lot of the kind of like fan art was around Spock himself. And you know, I think if Spock was a sex symbol, it would not surprise me to discover that Saru maybe had a certain fan base online. I would not be surprised if Saru were perhaps kind of like the diamond in the rough when it comes to like Discovery's kind of secret, like, you know, sex symbol.
Emphasis on rough.
With his, very, very rough. whatever you're into, I don't judge.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to yuck anybody's yum. Your personal site, the criticism extends past Star Trek, of course, and you also write for Escapist magazine, and I have to say that I've really been enjoying your YouTube takes with your In the Frame features.
That's been a huge thing. So basically, again, this is one of the things where I'm constantly stunned that this happens, and I'm kind of amazed and flattered and very humbled by it, to be honest, to be frank. Because again, I worked the kind of website for 9 years. I worked my own website for 9 years, and I think that anybody who is familiar with the mechanics of the entertainment industry knows that like it is very hard to get a job writing criticism, and in particular, it's very hard to get a job kind of writing criticism that is, you know, perhaps engaging or kind of deep reads or long thought. That sort of journalism isn't really that popular anymore. In fact, actually, you could argue that like reviews aren't even that common anymore because the recap has kind of supplanted them. Yeah. The idea of kind of like documenting and archiving and doing listicles has arguably become a lot of what entertainment journalism is. And, you know, I again, I like food. I like living. I like having a roof over my head. So I wasn't able to really kind of pursue entertainment journalism as a career that I would like to enjoy, because I you know, that stuff doesn't really interest me. It's not what I want to do. Again, I don't want to yuck anybody's yum, to borrow your phrase there. But if, you know, it's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to write long form opinion pieces about absolute nonsense that literally only I cared about.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, you know, is Clash of the Titans a secret metaphor for monotheism coming to Europe? Darren has some thoughts. That is actually an article, and I apologize to any listeners whose day I've ruined with that. But no, these are the things that I sit down, I watch movies and think about. So I would occasionally, like, I'd write these articles or I'd sit on Twitter, and I think Nick Calandra, who is the editor at The Escapist magazine, who arrived, I think, 2 years ago, basically, and kind of like had a remit to kind of tidy up and to reorganize and to restructure. He saw some of this stuff and he reached out to me and he said, would you like to write for the site? And I was like, yes, I would absolutely love to write for the site. I have some crazy pitches. And I think Nick, to this day, regrets that, because he wakes up every Tuesday morning to 20 pitches from me that are along the lines of, oh, hey, is Terry from Soul the secret hero of the movie? And it's like, Darren, I'm sleeping. It's like, no. This is vitally important. I have 1,000 words ready to go on this. And that sort of thing. But basically, so I wrote a couple of articles from the site. They generated a response. People seemed to like them. And Nick seemed to like them. And the staff seemed to like them. So they said, actually, would you like to launch a column with the site? And the column would be basically a weekly look at the Week in Geek, basically, as it were. And sure, obviously with a remit to cover everything that the fans of the site like, and maybe to bring in some new stuff as well. And I said, yeah, that would be fantastic. And then that did well, and it expanded to a twice weekly column, so it's on Mondays and Fridays, which was phenomenal as well. And Nick then asked, would we like to try and kind of transition to YouTube videos, which is something completely alien to me, and I have no idea what I'm doing, and I make no pretense that I have any idea what I'm doing, but I'm working with a staff of incredibly, like, competent, qualified people who know much better than I do about these things, including Omar Ahmed, who does the video editing on the In the Frame stuff that's released on Mondays, and the fantastic Matt J. Lachlan, who does like the other stuff that we do, so like the podcast, and he does the 3-minute reviews. And they've, like, again, I joke, and I'm not really joking, but I joke that, you know, the good stuff is all them, everything else is me. And basically, so I do through that. And I think actually that one of the reasons that you reached out to me was, again, one of those pitches that I'm sure Nick dreads waking up to, and like nobody on the face of this planet wants to read except me, which is, you know, Star Trek Discovery, in the first season of Star Trek Discovery, as an attempt to reconnect with the secret psychedelic roots of Star Trek.
right.
And it's an insane pitch. I freely admit that it's an insane pitch. It sounds completely bonkers. It's off the wall. It's kind of nuts. And yet it's something that when I was watching it, I was like, I think this makes sense. I think this is a cogent way of approaching the show. I don't think I've seen anybody else make this argument. I don't think I've seen anybody else connect these dots in the way that I have. Now, you know, you might say, well, the reason that they haven't is because, Darren, you're a secret genius who's managed to draw all these threads together. Or you might also equally rationally say, they haven't, Darren, because you're a complete madman and you're just drawing patterns in the sky. But, you know, I like to think the idea falls between the two stools. But yeah, so that's been kind of like the past year writing at The Escapist. I'm phenomenally, there's a little bit of arrogance in saying I'm proud of the work that I do there, but I'm kind of humble that I get the chance to do it, to be honest.
Well, you yelled into the void and the void yelled back and said, give us more.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And occasionally said, yeah, I'm not entirely sure I'd buy that, but it's, you got moxie, kid.
I keep yelling, yeah.
Yeah, I keep yelling. It's ambient noise. I just kind of like it. It makes it feel like I'm not alone in the darkness.
Well, you don't have zero experience in presenting. You host a podcast called The 250, where you're watching every film in the IMDb Top 250 movies. What's that been like?
Yes. And again, this is one of the things where, like every white guy in his mid-30s, I figure a time comes where you have to settle down and start a podcast. Now, this is one of the things where...
Or several. Again,
or several. Yeah, that's it exactly. No, I mean, you know, it says, I think you could probably, if you wanted to write a book about the idea, like the most revealing facet of, you know, kind of millennial life, yeah, is that like when our parents had midlife crises, they went off and bought Ferraris. When our generation has midlife crises, they write podcasts or they host podcasts.
Oh, if I could afford a Ferrari, I'd be in one right now.
Yeah, I know. But no, I mean, so the idea with the podcast is actually, and again, this is one of the things where this is a crass generalization. I apologize in general, and I don't mean to insinuate about anybody else's life. But one of the things that I have discovered as I've gotten older is that men, and again, generalization alert here, but generally speaking, men don't tend to maintain long-form relationships with other men in the same way that women do. Because, you know, obviously you have, like, my partner has a set group of friends, and she's been friends with them since school, and they will kind of meet up every, you know, once or twice a month, and they'll kind of chat and make sure that everybody's okay with stuff. But, you know, I don't know if men do that on a regular basis. We typically need to come up with an excuse to do something, because otherwise it's just awkward social interaction. So it's like, we'll start, like, a bowling league, for example. Sure. We actually did start a bowling league. But one of the things that a friend from school suggested was he suggested doing a podcast because, you know, that's a kind of a thing that people do when they reach a certain age. So myself and my good friend Andrew Quinn, who I've known since I was a child in Sligo, started a podcast together called The 250. And the idea of The 250 was to basically, he wanted to do a podcast. I wanted to do a podcast that I was comfortable doing. So it was like, yeah, we're doing a podcast on film. And we wanted to do a podcast on films that A, people have seen, and B, if they haven't seen them, they might want to see them.
Yeah.
So we thought that it would be a list of kind of great films. And we thought, well, okay, let's look at the lists of great films that are out there. And you have various kind of lists of great films. You have like the AFI's list, you have the Sight and Sound poll, you have all these sort of lists of kind of what are the greatest films ever made. And we decided that we'd go with the IMDb list. And the reason for that was quite simple and quite calculated, which is the IMDb list is bonkers and it's fascinating. Yeah. Like, and I say this as somebody who has hosted at this stage, I think 220 episodes covering it. It is a list where you will see like obscure European movies, like, for example, Ingmar Bergman's Autumn Sonata, which entered back in November. Huh. And it rubbing shoulders alongside like Taylor Tate's The Help. You know, the kind of like weird film like that. And then it's also like, oh, Joker is the ninth best film of all time. But that's OK, because it's like directly above The Seven Samurai. And it's like, this is an insane list, but it's dynamic. It's constantly changing. And I think that you can do something interesting with it where you kind of like, and this is something that generally fascinates me about pop culture, is that like pop culture as a mirror, where you look at things like the IMDb list and you see it almost like reading tea leaves, and you see kind of shifts that are taking place in it, and they're shifts that maybe you wouldn't have recognized if you weren't looking at it. So for example, there's a huge number of kind of Indian films that have come into the list over the past 10 years.
Huh.
And that's something that like isn't discussed in main culture, main pop culture at all. The kind of the idea that obviously we're aware that Bollywood is a thing and that it exists and it is a large film industry, but we're generally not aware of the extent to which it is comparable to Hollywood, but also the extent to which it's reaching beyond India itself. It's extending into foreign markets and is challenging Hollywood as a global film market. And again, the rise of kind of China as well. Last year was, you know, for very obvious reasons, to be very clear, the first year that a non-American, you know, non-English language film had been the highest grossing film at the global box office.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you look at things like the IMDb 250. And again, one of the interesting things is when you see something you can't explain and you do a bit of digging on it, because it's always fun to do digging, you can typically kind of trace it back to things like, oh, wow, this was completely outside my area of expertise or influence, and it wasn't something I thought about. So let's pick Hatchie, A Dog's Tale.
Right.
The movie starring Richard Gere about Hatchie, who is a dog, and the dog comes into his life and he changes it. And it's very moving and it's very affecting. It's also something like the 214th best movie of all time, according to IMDb. This is a movie that was almost sold to Hallmark. It was apparently like within inches of being sold to the Hallmark Channel. And you watch it and you're like, what is this doing on the list? And then you do a bunch of research and you discover that, yeah, sure, it wasn't a big deal in America and nobody saw it. It had a bum opening weekend. It is airing on Hallmark right now. It made no cultural impact whatsoever. But you go to Douban, which is the Chinese version of IMDb, and it's the 8th highest movie of all time. And more than that, there's also like in China, there's this huge industry around movies starring anthropomorphized animals. In fact, I believe they organized a convention back in 2018 in which they got together a number of like famous poodles and dogs and cats from like very big films that happen to feature dogs and cats. Again, you think of things like, say, The Palm Dog, those sort of things, like Oogie from The Artist and that sort of thing. And again, this is something that I had never thought of. It had never crossed my mind to be aware that this was something that happened.
Huh.
And yet reading about it, it was like, oh yeah, now that makes sense. And it's like, okay, yep, this is a cultural force. This is a cultural force that I had no awareness of or that I haven't seen really covered or discussed anywhere else. But yeah, this is where we're going. And it kind of like that's why we kind of latched on doing the kind of IMDb 250.
Wow, that really shoots my theory of IMDb and their ratings, because I always thought of IMDb as something that we really need, but something that I don't much like using. And maybe it's just flashbacks from the old days of the IMDb forums before they were rightfully killed with fire. But people have wildly varying opinions on movies, and there is sort of like an egalitarianism to the site, because you've got people who I'm sure consider themselves to be film experts, and you have people who just took the time to make an IMDb account to tell you, I really like this movie. And so there's a sort of like a winnowing of the chaff, you know, for at least these films are significant. People are talking about the films that are, you know, in the top 10, but it means it's films like The Dark Knight and Godfather and yeah. Shawshank still number one somehow. All good films. But skewed heavily, presumably, by the middle-aged male demographic of the site. And I would have said white middle-aged male, but now you're telling me that, like, you know, with the inclusion of Indian and Chinese users, are these, like, are there middle-aged men in their basements in those two countries as well, who are now raising films like Hachi and Indian films up to the 250?
Well, I mean, again, this is one of the things where it absolutely is interesting. Again, like, that was the kind of dark side. The dark side is exactly what you mentioned there. This is a list that is indicative of like the best and worst of pop culture.
Mm.
And again, not to jump too heavily on this kind of bandwagon and stuff like that, and kind of like to bring the podcast down, but you look at it and you're like, you look at films that make the list. And so pretty much any popular Marvel film is going to make the list. So Civil War made the list. Mm. The Winter Soldier made the list. Ragnarok made the list. You know, Infinity War was the ninth greatest movie of all time, according to the list. Endgame was the sixth greatest movie of all time, according to the list.
Wow.
But what you'll notice is that, like, of those, what are the billion-dollar Marvel movies that didn't make the list? They're Black Panther and they're Captain Marvel. And it's like, you know, I mean, everybody's taste is inherently subjective, but I think that when you look at that, it's a little bit icky. And again, you look at things like, say, the bottom 100, which is like the list's evil twin.
Right.
And like, so you mentioned there that like the top 250 has a character, and it definitely does have a character. We're talking about movies like Fight Club. I mean, you mentioned The Shawshank Redemption as the best movie of all time. I don't know how much time we have, but very quickly, do you know how that happened? Because this is very revealing and not in a very flattering way.
Well, I know that the film was not a success upon release, but somehow has become like this cherished treasure, you know, for men of a certain age.
Well, the reason why The Shawshank Redemption is the greatest movie of all time on IMDb is because it was the last man standing in a voting war between Godfather and Dark Knight fans, where each was pathologically downvoting the other. Like, there were campaigns and bots and wars being waged, where the Godfather was the incumbent at number one, and the Dark Knight was coming up fast behind it. And everybody was getting so intense with this that by the time, like, the dust settled and the blood was on the floor, Shawshank Redemption, which had managed to avoid upsetting the Dark Knight fans and kind of, or the Godfather fans, just kind of waltzed to the throne after that.
Just slipped out through the pipe.
Yeah, that's exactly. Nobody hates the Shawshank Redemption.
That's
right?
True.
But like, yeah, and you're right that it is dominated by this kind of like very middle-aged male gaze, or kind of like, you know, I was 12 in 1999 kind of male gaze.
Sure,
so films like, say, Fight Club are in there as well. And, you know, films like Pulp Fiction.
It's in my DNA, too. I totally randomly picked The Dark Knight and The Godfather. And then now you're telling me that it's like this three-way war between them.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, like, I love those films. I think those films are legitimately great and fantastic. But like, you look at a list of 250 films and you're like, yeah, maybe we can see a little bit of diversity creeping in there. And to be fair, it is happening. So obviously I mentioned the Indian stuff, but even films like, say, Capernaum, which is, you know, kind of like this film that performed, this lovely little indie film, it coming in, stuff like, say, Autumn Sonata, Ingrid Bergman's kind of like Swedish language kind of like showcase coming in as well. And you see changes happening gradually over time, but it's very slowly and it's very much kind of pebbles down the side of a mountain. And it's very, very clearly happening with pushback. So like, I know without looking that like Promising Young Woman will never make the list because of its content, its theme, and because of how it's sold. I know that's never going to happen. I know that Birds of Prey was never going to do it. I knew that Wonder Woman 2 was never going to do it even before the reviews came out, because that mindset and that kind of like reflexive, aggressive online kind of vote locking happens as well. And again, you look at things like, say, the bottom 100, which I mentioned was the evil twin of the top 250. And like, if the top 250 is stacked full of these movies that men in their 20s in 1999 loved, the bottom 100 is packed with movies that these men loathed and hated. Movies like, say, Spice World, for example, or Crossroads. Yeah, no, I mean, like, Spice World is not a great film, but it's a fun film, it's a joyous film, and it's not one of the worst films ever made by any stretch of the imagination. And you look at, say, new entries on the bottom 100, like, say, Sofia Takal's Black Christmas. And it's like, you look at that and it's like, okay, it's not a great film. I think it's interesting. I think it's ambitious. I think it's saying interesting things. But it's like, I know the reason why it's on the bottom 100. And I know the reason why Artemis Fowl, which is, you know, by any measure, not a better film than it, is not on the bottom 100, because it didn't tick the people off. It didn't tick the people who are going to pathologically kind of vote it down off. Yeah. So yeah, there absolutely is. You're entirely right that, like, again, in terms of a cultural snapshot, a lot of it is interesting and fun and insightful and kind of revealing. And a lot of it is, kind of not. A lot of it is very dark and depressing. And, well, a reminder that, you know, not to use the phrase that's perhaps overused, but the culture war that is perhaps waging around other aspects of popular culture, including, sadly, Star Trek, but also, say, Star Wars and Doctor Who, that doesn't exist in a vacuum, and it's been happening for a very, very long time.
Well, I got to get started on this bottom 100 podcast, though.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating. Again, like, and like, some of the stuff on there is gloriously bad. So, like, Mac and Me, for example, on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, stuff that you can understand being on there, like the 1990 Captain America movie. But a lot of the bottom 100, you look at it and you go, wait, like, there's a lot of female pop star movies on here. And you're like, I sense a trend here, and it's not a very flattering trend for men who were, like, 20 years old in 1999.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now that this is a movie podcast, maybe we should move on a little bit to, I can talk about this forever, to Star Trek. Why did you choose this specific episode, The Immunity Factor, to discuss today?
Because I actually thought it would be kind of fun, because I know you mentioned we kind of reached out in terms of something I'd written about Discovery, and I think it was the article about kind of the psychedelia in particular.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of like when I look at the psychedelia of Star Trek, obviously there's any number of episodes you can think of, but The Immunity Syndrome is one that really jumps out at me, because it's an episode that I think this is pretty much perfect as far as Star Trek episodes go, and I think it's sorely underrated, sorely underappreciated, and doesn't get enough love for kind of what it does. Mm. It's such a weird episode, but it's also a weird episode that does a lot of what Star Trek, the original series, kind of does, particularly in its first and second seasons, and which a lot of people forget that it does, and it kind of like crystallizes those in a way that is really good and really fun and really exciting. Because again, you know, a lot of episodes that do a lot of the stuff that this does, a lot of the weird stuff, a lot of the odd stuff, to be frank, they're not necessarily great. But I think that this one really, truly is. I think it's a very clever piece of science fiction. I think it's incredibly well written. I think it's got very, very clever things to say. And I think it's aged remarkably well. And I think that it is a nice snapshot of the version of the original Star Trek series that I think fans tend to forget. I think fans tend to overlook and tend to ignore. And I think it's worth celebrating kind of in that context.
And it takes place, or was created, at a time of great transition in the Star Trek edifice as well. And I think, I don't know, I think you can kind of see it as possibly the beginning of the end, or at least the prologue to the third season, which some people call the third season, but I like a lot of third season episodes. This is one of those TOS episodes that really bugs me. I always mess up the title. You know, you could write a pretty simple computer program that could give you a typical TOS title, you know, adjective, noun. You know, you've got the immunity syndrome, the doomsday machine, the alternative factor, the ultimate computer.
The Omega Glory.
There's a taste of Armageddon, which I always call the Armageddon factor, getting it mixed up with the Doctor Who serial. And then there's the Space 1999 episode called The Immunity Syndrome, which is a completely different story from this.
Yeah, and don't forget Armageddon Game from Deep Space Nine, which I also get confused with those two as well.
Yep.
I love generic Star Trek episode titles. They're kind of great. Because again, like, if you looked at the Immunity Syndrome, I mean, obviously it has thematic relevance to the episode that we're about to discuss. And there's like, you could tie it back in. And it's in many ways kind of the linchpin of what the episode is about, in inverted commas. But it's also like such a weird generic name. Like, you could also call The Deadly Years the Immunity Syndrome, for example, if you wanted to. You could probably call, you know, like The Naked Time the Immunity Syndrome, and it would work just as well. That sort of stuff. It is very, very generic in terms of like confusing your Star Trek episodes, which may be why it's kind of forgotten or overlooked, I think. Also, the fact that it comes, you know, after the good part of the second season, to be frank.
Well, yeah, to be totally honest, yeah. And just to note, there is a 1970 Japanese film called Space Amoeba.
Nice. Does it have an exclamation mark in it? Because it sounds like it needs an exclamation mark.
No, it really does, yeah. But I think maybe it doesn't translate totally the same way. Well, we are talking about the TOS episode, The Immunity Syndrome. As I mentioned, it is the 19th or perhaps 18th, depending on how you're counting in the release date. It first aired on January 19th of 1968. It was written by Robert Sabaroff. Sabaroff wrote many single scripts for 60s genre shows like Bonanza, Tarzan, and The Invaders. He co-created, along with Denbart Petticlerk, the 1970 series Then Came Bronson, and also contributed a script to that show, which was produced, of course, by former TOS producers Robert Justman and Herb Solow. And Sabaroff also wrote the story and wrote the teleplay for the TNG Season 1 episode Home Soil, and he wrote the story for the episode Conspiracy. This episode was directed by Joseph Pevney. Pevney was a former vaudeville and film actor who directed over 30 feature films and many, many episodes of TV from the 60s all the way to the 80s when he retired. He directed some of Trek's most beloved episodes, including Arena, The Devil in the Dark, The City on the Edge of Forever, and more. He's tied with series director Mark Daniels for the most number of episodes directed at 14, and he was one of the show's go-to directors in the show's first and second seasons. He left the series after directing The Immunity Syndrome because he felt that the quality of the writing on the show had deteriorated and that the actors were too undisciplined following the departure of series showrunner Gene Kuhn. And I have to say, if the guy who shot out Arena in like 6 days thinks that you're not disciplined enough, he might be right, but that sounds like a guy that's got a pretty high standard.
But again, like, understandably, it's notable that he, I think, picked up 3 Hugo nominations
and
a win back in 1968, because he did The City on the Edge of Forever, The Trouble with Tribbles, and he did A Mock Time. Like, this is very much like one of the gold standard Star Trek directors. And again, you could kind of see why doing The Immunity Syndrome would be kind of ending on a low in terms of kind of what he's doing, because I think you kind of alluded to it there. It arrives at a point of transition for the show. And obviously, you mentioned the departure of Gene L. Kuhn. John Meredith Lucas had kind of arrived and taken over. And I think that, like, this was one of the stories, because it wasn't a clean break, because it wasn't, you know, like at the end of a season.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily that like there was a clean break between the episodes. You see stories coming in and going out that would have been commissioned or encouraged by Kuhn, but developed under Lucas. I mean, to pick an example, you know, I think a piece of The Action is written by Kuhn, but it's kind of developed by Lucas, which is a very interesting in terms of getting your flavors wrong there. But the thing is that you have, the episode basically came about because basically the budget was spent, which is a recurring motif in terms of production of classic Star Trek episodes.
Yes.
And basically, so they'd kind of like spent their budget on the guest cast for the season and gone a little bit over. And you can kind of imagine why, given that Journey to Babel was quite recent and was Joseph Pevney's, I think, previous credit before this one. So basically, I think that they told Sabarov that, you know, you can have this episode. It just has to be a bottle show. And you can have a special effect if you want, because it's cheaper than paying a guest cast member. And again, it's kind of interesting. This is one of the things where I put my little angry nerd television fan hat on.
Oh, no.
And it's like, because people talk about the term bottle episode, and the term bottle episode, you know, has changed a great deal. When people say bottle episode, I think there was a list, I can't remember if it was The Ringer or somewhere like that, published like the greatest bottle episodes in television history.
Yeah.
And you looked at it and you were like, that's not what a bottle episode is. So like Pine Barrens is not a bottle episode of The Sopranos.
They're outside
the entire time. So a bottle episode is designed to save budget. It's designed to be shot on standing sets. It's designed to primarily give speaking roles to existing cast members or to kind of like repertoire company players. Mm-hmm. It's designed to minimize budget in that way. And again, you'd frequently see this on Star Trek shows where you had to produce 20, 24, 26, 29 episodes in a season. And in order to kind of like make the budget stretch, you would basically do a bottle episode every once in a while. Again, there's any number of ones you can point to. Remember Me from the fourth season of Star Trek The Next Generation is a great example where they literally just erase everybody but the cast,
right.
In order to, and eventually everybody in the cast as well, in order to justify it. Or Shuttlepod 1 on, say, Enterprise, where it's literally just Reed and Trip on the shuttle set for 45 minutes. And, you know, the Immunity Syndrome is kind of interesting in that respect, because it is very much a bottle episode. It's very much on the ship. There's no awaity mission. Outside of maybe, I think Kyle has a couple of lines here or there, it's primarily the existing cast who get it. And it becomes this kind of like really weird, really quiet chamber piece where the characters are just kind of talking at one another on these sets. And I mean, even when they go down to engineering to visit Scott, for example, you can tell the budget has been trimmed and there really aren't that many extras kind of wandering around. So it has this kind of eerie quality to it as well, where it's kind of haunted. Yeah. I mean, you could argue that the plot element that kind of comes up with McCoy saying, oh my God, the entire crew has been deflated like a balloon.
Right.
Which is perhaps also a metaphor. Yeah, which is also perhaps a metaphor for how everybody felt at this point in the second season.
Yeah.
But it was arguably a justification for explaining why there were so few crew wandering around on these sets at certain points.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh yeah, no, everybody's in sick bay. Everybody's just taking a day off. It's been a long week, you know?
It's a sweaty episode, too. Everybody's glistening.
Well, that's Shatner giving his most. Again, you mentioned there the kind of discussion that Pevney had, and he's like, you reading between the lines of Pevney's complaint, particularly when he's talking to Starlog magazine, it's very clear that he's talking about the vying egos of kind of the main cast and the idea of the writers, the tail wagging the dog, the writers being terrified to turn in scripts that maybe favored Spock over Kirk, for example.
Right.
Yeah. Because at this stage, Shatner, and again, this is something that's been covered everywhere else, everybody's written about this in great depth, it's not any particularly new insight, but Shatner, you know, was reportedly counting lines in scripts in order to make sure that he had equal coverage to Nimoy. And you can see that throughout, because I think that one of the quotes from Pevney where he says, you know, now there's kind of challenging between the two of them on screen. Now, this is okay in life and in rehearsal, but it shouldn't be there on screen.
Yeah.
And you're watching the episode, and there's an early sequence with Kirk and Spock where Kirk is like, I'm not asking you to tell. Insufficient isn't sufficient, Mr. Spock.
Yeah.
And it's like, this doesn't feel like Kirk talking to Spock. This feels very much like Shatner putting the boot down and making sure that Nimoy knows exactly who's in charge of this particular scene.
Hmm. That's interesting, but I think that kind of, I don't know, that produces a friction, I think, in the conflict between them. And if, I think it's funny that, like, you know, Joe Pevney quits this and he immediately walks into, like, six episodes of The Rifleman, and then he goes on to Have Gun Will Travel, and he clearly, like, this didn't hurt his career in any way at all. He just kept yelling at other actors and other sets. But if we had continued on in that vein, you know, maybe we would have the sort of static kind of show, the kind of thing that you see in early TNG, where everybody is just sort of wooden and they're fulfilling their naval duties and then making the odd crack about what the alien looks like or something like that. I mean, these are the episodes and the things that I think about when I think about the interplay between co-officers, but friends as well, and people who know each other and rely on each other for information, for that data.
No, there's very much, like, again, a very strong interpersonal dynamic at play here. Like, again, the fact that, like, this is an episode, and we'll probably get to the weird kind of psychedelic stuff that's going on with the giant space amoeba, because I feel like we can't just talk around the giant space amoeba. But, like, even outside of that, though, despite the fact it's dealing with this kind of, like, very larger-than-life kind of scale problem, there's a lot of banter between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and there's a lot of tension between them as well. And the episode obviously has the central tension of, well, who's going to take the shuttle out?
Yeah.
Kirk has to decide who it's going to be, and McCoy wants it to be him, and Spock wants it to be him, and the two of them are kind of vying, and they're, you know, the idea that, you know, is the tension between the professional, is it that McCoy thinks that he's more qualified than Spock, but is it also perhaps that he wants to sacrifice himself and he wouldn't give Spock the satisfaction of admitting that to him? And you have all this stuff kind of playing, which is actually really interesting character drama, and which works in large part because you were mentioned at the very start of this, the kind of chemistry that you have between the three leads, between Shatner, Nimoy, and Kelly, where each of them embodies the characters perfectly, but you bring them together and you have this friction, which, you know, no disrespect, I love all of the other Star Trek shows. In fact, I would argue that The Next Generation has probably the best ensemble cast of any Star Trek production ever. And I think that some of my favorite individual actors are on Deep Space Nine, to pick an an example. Yeah. But I do think that you never quite replicated that kind of tension that exists between the three leading characters on the original Star Trek, between, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and between those three actors. And I think you're entirely right that, you know, the fact that maybe Shatner and Nimoy were vying for kind of the spotlight plays into it. I mean, there are famous stories here, you know, again, not to retread old ground, but how remarkably petty Shatner could be. Like, when he discovered, I think at one point, that Nimoy was going to leave early to record an interview, he apparently had stagehands hide Nimoy's bike in the ceiling so that he couldn't leave. And these are grown men. These are grown men.
Clear the pigeons out. We got to fit this bike up there. I think that it's possible, and I don't think that they necessarily tried to completely replicate that in future shows. I think that the closest that we maybe get is to Paul Archer and Trip. Yeah. If it was just Archer and Trip teaming up on T'Pol all the time instead of the sort of sometimes we'll all pick on Spock, sometimes we'll all pick on McCoy, you know, but I'm the boss still, I'm Kirk. But yeah, I mean, that's just what people think of and people remember when they think about a TOS. I should say real quick that the start date for the episode is 4307.1. And usually at this point, your assignment would be to give us a 25-word synopsis of the immunity syndrome.
Space amoeba.
Okay. That's an economy of words. Which is exactly what they're facing in this episode. Brought to life by special effects by Frank Vanderveer of Vanderveer Photo Effects, who had also worked on a couple other episodes. And it employs a technique that I'm passingly familiar with. Younger viewers might not remember at all, but it's when you put a mixture of liquids between two thin sheets of glass and sort of move it around or put push air through it. It's the kind of thing that you'd see at a rock show in the 60s. Where they, you know, project it up, you know, on a projector for a freak out. I mean, I've seen it in movies like The Doors. I wasn't at any 60s rock shows, sadly.
But yeah, no, it definitely is. And I mean, that's what's interesting is that that's a huge selling point for the episode. I think the TV Guide, like introduction to the episode, proudly boasted, "This episode features psychedelic special effects created by Frank Vanderveer," which is great. And I mean, like, part of that is obviously down to the fact that we have no budget, we have no guest stars. Yeah, so what the hell are we going to sell this on?
Oh, by the way, our guest star is the Mr. Amoeba.
To you, please. His agent was very demanding that he get title billing in the Japanese remake, apparently. But no, yes. We should point out, actually, the reason why the budget was so low was also the fact that I think this is the first episode that aired after Paramount bought Desilu, or the first episode was produced after Paramount bought Desilu, which was apparently the point at which people arrived and started tightening the screws in terms of budget. So, like, the show had been running dramatically over. And again, the show had been doing a tremendous job in terms of getting these episodes produced on schedule and with a, you know, reasonable amount of kind of, like, budget overrun. But with the arrival of Paramount, they were told, no, everything will be new on bosses. Budget. That's it, and we'll be kind of keeping track. But to bring it back to kind of Vanderveer, because I think that's one of the things that I really like about the episode, one of the things I find really striking about it, is that it is a very, very trippy episode. It is an episode in which McCoy is repeatedly shooting up the crew with
Everybody's stimulants. Juicing the whole time,
stimulants, just to keep them fresh and kind of edge. Everybody's microdosing.
Yeah, they catch up with you.
over the course of the episode. But, like, because this is the thing that I think, and this is something I find interesting with Star Trek fandom, and something I find kind of, like, interesting in general, is the idea that Star Trek is relatively grounded, or Star Trek is kind of, you know, relatively serious, or it's kind of pseudoscience is inherently more grounded than, say, Star Wars. And it absolutely is, to be clear. But I think that there are points at which people maybe take that a bit too far and where that becomes a bit arbitrary. Because I think that one of the interesting things that gets forgotten about TOS, and I suspect this is in large part due to the fact that, you know, a lot of modern Star Trek fans are my age and kind of your age. They're the generation that came of age with The Next Generation, in particular with the pillar years of The Next Generation, where Star Trek was a bit more explicitly rational, where Star Trek was a bit more scientific, where technobabble tended to be constructed of, like, actual syllables from scientific sounding words, as opposed to just, like, psychedelic jargon.
Right.
But one of the things that I find really interesting when you go back and watch the original Star Trek is how much of a kind of an existential horror show that it is. And again, you have, like, this recurring motif that runs through the first season, where the entire universe seems to be populated by dead civilizations.
Yes.
Like, you look at the first episode that was produced, which is The Cage, which is basically the Talosians, which are like, oh yeah, by the way, we're a dead civilization of mutants, of grotesque mutants, who can no longer propagate ourselves. And it's like, we need some young, virile Americans to show up and show us how it's done. But you look at things like, say, even the first episode that aired, which is The Man Trap, which again is the Soul Vampire as the last relic of its own civilization, kind of a the ruins. But you look at things like, say, you know, obviously going through the season, things like, say, Charlie X, where you have those aliens that have moved on. You have things like, say, the Squire of Gothos, where, you know, the only god in the universe is an errant child who needs to be told to behave himself, basically. Right. You have even like episodes that kind of take place along the ruins. I think The Enemy Within has ruins in them as well. And like, it plays throughout this kind of sense that the universe is just populated by dead civilizations.
Space gothic. Yeah.
Space gothic as well. Yeah, exactly. And again, the influence of, say, people like Robert Bloch, who would have written like What Are Little Girls Made Of and Cat's Paw, mm-hmm. and kind of Wolf in the Fold, who was a horror writer primarily and heavily influenced by Lovecraft. And I think that, you know, we tend to, when we talk about Star Trek, when we talk about The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, there's a tendency to focus on how much of that universe we know, because obviously it's the franchise has been running at this stage for well over 50 years. We have resources like Memory Alpha. We have kind of like websites online that categorize and explain how the universe of Star Trek is supposed to work. But what I find interesting when you go back to the original Star Trek, it's not even that the writers haven't figured out how the universe is supposed to work. They repeatedly suggest the universe doesn't work at all. And that should terrify us. The fact that we don't understand, like, there's that, again, you know, the Abrams movies are divisive among fans, but there's that quote from McCoy where he talks about how space is disease and darkness wrapped in death and silence.
Yeah.
And you watch the original Star Trek and it's like, yes it is, because Kirk has had to explain to God knows how many families that, you know, their relatives froze to death or were kind of infected by a wave of insanity sweeping across the cosmos, you know, or, you know, sort of like they got sucked up by a Soul Vampire, which we didn't even know existed, but apparently is a thing that we need to worry about. There's a space vampire cloud out there. There's a, you know, there's a doomsday machine. The great, I think, was it Peter David in one of his novels, I think it was one of his Q novels, made the joke that, you know, you have to imagine, given everything that happened afterwards, given everything that we know about the Star Trek universe after the fact, that, you know, at Starfleet headquarters, people reading Kirk's mission reports had to assume that he was making it all up, or was like high on goofballs, or was like infected by these spores, because it makes no sense whatsoever. Yeah. But that's very much kind of the point of it. And again, people talk about Star Trek and its presentation of the future, and I think that is hugely important. I think it's a vital part of what the franchise is and what it does. Its presentation of what the future is going to be like, and its idea that maybe the future can be better. That thing that we talked about that Doctor Who's kind of lacking at the moment, this idea that the future will be better, and this kind of utopian ideal of like the next generation of Voyager. And I think that's true, and I think that's very worth celebrating. But I think that what people tend to miss is how the Star Trek franchise always reflects its present as well. Like, I think when people talk about the optimism of The Next Generation Deep Space Nine, and particularly when they say, man, I really wish Star Trek could be optimistic again. What happened to optimistic Star Trek? And it's like, yes, but you're missing the fact that, like, The Next Generation and Voyager were not a roadmap to the future. No. They were a reflection of the present. They reflected, like, the unipolar moment after the Cold War, the moment at which America had emerged as a global superpower. There were no major wars waging. The economy was booming, unemployment was relatively low, crime was falling, everybody was as happy as they were going to be for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that is why The Next Generation seems to take place in a utopia, and why Voyager never seems to have any serious problems despite being stranded on the other side of the galaxy with no support whatsoever. It's it'll be fine, which is something that audiences could believe watching television in 1995.
Yeah.
And I think that what you miss then when you try to extrapolate that into a core philosophy for the franchise is going back and watching the original Star Trek as a product of the 60s, which were a highly turbulent time.
Yeah.
And again, we point to, and again, one of the big touchstones in terms of like modern politics is people are constantly saying, oh, well, is 2016 really a replaying of 1968? Is 2018 a secret replaying of 1968? Is 2019 a secret replaying of 1968? Because these were hugely turbulent times in American politics. And when we talk about Star Trek, we try and smooth it over and we try and make it one thing, and it's not at all. And even individual shows are not one thing. So we talk about the liberalism and the idealism of Star Trek. And we talk about Star Trek and its kind of anti-war, its anti-Vietnam sentiment. And that is absolutely true when you look at episodes like Errand of Mercy, or when you look at episodes like Trials and Tribulations, or you look at episodes like Mirror, Mirror, or Day of the Dove. Those are all very strongly anti-Vietnam episodes. They're very anti-war. A Taste of Armageddon. Gene L. Coon was the master of this.
Yeah.
But then you also have episodes that are reflecting the fact that this is not somebody writing about the Vietnam War in 1995 and going, well, in hindsight it was a mistake, yeah, and we never should have been there. No. This is in 1967 and 68 when America was having these debates and people were going, actually no, maybe it's a just war, maybe it's necessary, maybe it's right, maybe we have to do it to preserve Western civilization. And you look at the show and you see that argument play out. And again, this is going to be controversial to the listeners, I apologize for this, but the City on the Edge of Forever, you know, isn't just about the Second World War. It's arguing that sometimes war is necessary.
Yeah.
And when you're arguing that sometimes war is necessary in 1968, you are probably arguing about Vietnam. And I think that, like, Robert Justman himself has said, yes, we were talking about Vietnam in that context. But you look at episodes like, say, Friday's Child, you look at episodes like A Private Little War, you even look at episodes, and again, one in each of every Star Trek season, episodes like, for example, Return of the Archons in the first season, The Apple in the second season, or The World is Hollow and I've Touched the Sky in the third season, which are all stories about Kirk landing and fixing a primitive society and saving them from a monstrous robotic overlord. And it's like, in the context of 1966, 67, 68, 69, that is a metaphor for Vietnam, because that is how Vietnam was sold to the American public. It was the Americans going in and saving these people who were being oppressed and infected by the cold, unfeeling touch of communism and needing to save them from these beliefs. Yeah. And you see all this stuff kind of playing out. And one of the things that really played out in the 60s was this idea of kind of, well, first of all, mutually assured destruction, but this idea of insanity. The 60s were an absolutely insane decade in terms of, like, understanding what was happening in the world. And they were insane in terms of the nuclear weapons and kind of mutually assured destruction. And, you know, things like, say, the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we came to destruction there. Things like, say, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the death of a U.S. president, which was earth-shattering to people at the time.
Yeah.
You look at things like, say, the protest movement that was happening on campus and the idea of kind of like the anti-war protests and, like, Timothy Leary trying to levitate the Pentagon. If you were somebody in your 30s or 40s in the 1960s looking out the window, you could not make sense of this world. Everything was happening crazily and, like, insanely in a way that I think is, you know, mirrored in, you look on Twitter today and it's like, yes, this is probably what it felt to somebody watching the news in the late 60s. And I think that Star Trek covers that very, very well. And there's this kind of recurring motif that runs through the show of, like, insanity spreading across the universe, or insanity as a contagious force. You look at episodes like, say, Operation Annihilate from the end of the first season, and you watch that and it's hard not to think of, you know, kind of what Americans saw happening on college campuses, or even kind of like in big cities with kind of protests and stuff like that, and going, yep, that's what this is actually about. And so I look at something like the Immunity Syndrome and I see that as reflecting that mood more abstractly, because what's interesting is, you know, we joke about the space amoeba and we'll probably come back to that because I think that that's important thematically, but the core point of the episode, at least for its first half, is that this doesn't make sense. Nothing that's going on here conforms to any law of physics or science as we understand them.
Yeah.
And, like, they talk about that journey, you know, into darkness. We're heading into the dark void.
Yeah.
We're pushing forward, but we're getting some reverse movement as well. It's literally opposite day. This idea that, you know, like, even being in this space that we're in is affecting the crew. And it's not affecting the crew in any way that, like, science or medicine can confirm. It's just a kind of a psychic dread that's hanging over them.
Like the malaise. Yeah.
That's it, exactly. Referred to as like letting air out of a balloon, which is not a medical diagnosis.
we are
deeply deflating. And, like, that's kind of what I think that this episode captures quite well. Because obviously you can point to any number of episodes that do, like, crazy ass psychedelic stuff, including, like, Wolf in the Fold,
which
is one of my favorite episodes to show people who have no experience of what Star Trek was like. Because it's like, yep, Jack the Ripper is a psychic presence. He infects Scotty, murders a woman, and also is now the Enterprise's computer. And it's like, that happened. That was actually an episode of Star Trek. But, like, I think that, like, the Immunity Syndrome does that, but does it as actual drama and does it, like, with actual character work and does it in a way that kind of makes thematic sense. Because, again, you have all this stuff happening. It's, the psychedelic artwork isn't just something that looks cool. It isn't just something that was thrown into the episode because, the kids will love it and it'll give TV Guide like a nice blurb. Like, from the opening moments of the episode, the teaser to the episode is Spock experiencing a psychic blast from the death of 400 Vulcans across space. Again, with, like, the characters pointing out that this does not conform to rationality. This doesn't, even allowing for what we know of Vulcans and how Vulcan, you know, biology works. And even, like, the mind meld. I think, Kirk and McCoy point out, like, you've done the mind meld before. We know how the rules of the mind meld work in Star Trek. This was not that. And I kind of like that idea of there just being this oppressive psychic atmosphere of something being intrinsically wrong with the world. And I really kind of respond to in the Mindy Syndrome, and that's what I think it captures. And it's something that kind of is threaded through Star Trek in its first and second season and is often overlooked and ignored. And I think that the Mindy Syndrome is really the best example of that. It just brings it to the surface.
That's fascinating. It's when, you know, before we knew everything, like now we know everything about space. For the most part, we've seen black holes and all the science tells us that it's kind of empty and boring and it's not going to come back into a crunch. It's all just going to, you know, go and be a heat death of the universe, you know, the most boring way to die possible. But back then they didn't know that if, you know, when they landed on the moon, they would sink into moon dust a mile deep. You know, it was scary. And you've got somebody like poor Joe Tourmaline, who's like, we can't be out here, man. What are we doing? Like, you know, if we're supposed to be in space, we'd be able to breathe vacuum. And just seeing that come out, something that really gets me about the use of 60s ideas or tropes on Trek, like the psychedelic visuals, or you know, the idea of free love, or even the multiracial makeup of the crew, is that they're being employed by a bunch of white male World War II vets, you know, who probably have never even been to a rock concert. Period. It's really admirable that they wanted to make a show like this, but sometimes it comes off kind of like, hey, dude, you know, I'm hip, I'm with it, I'm groovy too.
That 30 Rock scene where kind of like Steve Buscemi shows up and says, how do you do, fellow kid?
Yeah.
But like that's the thing, is like we talk about like psychedelia. We talk about like the show engaging with psychedelia. It's worth noting that like its explicit engagements with kind of hippie counterculture are both very unflattering to both it and hippie counterculture. I mean, the big one is obviously Way to Eden. The Way to Eden, which is just a disaster from top to bottom. I think, and what's really weird watching it is that, like, although it's a disaster from top to bottom, and although it comes across as old man shakes fist at cloud, the most frustrating part of it is that, like, you can tell watching it that the old man thought he was also grooving along, even though he was a bit worried about the direction these kids were going. Because Spock jams with the hippies, which is very much like our sympathy is meant to be with Spock. So it's like Spock is a figure of counterculture. Okay, we're meant to say that, like, these kids are cool, but it's like, no, the script is just terrible. Nobody who has written the script has ever interacted with possibly another human being, but certainly not a human teenager or a member of the counterculture.
Sure.
But even say things like, you know, sort of This Side of Paradise from the first season, which is also kind of similarly about kind of counterculture in that it's about spores. And I mean, come on.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
about spores.
Yeah.
And it's about like trippy dippy kind of like, well, what if we like give up our responsibilities? What if we stop like, you know, doing what society expects us to do? What if we embrace other ideas and like free love and communicate with our emotions, man? And it's like, well, yes, that would cause the downfall of civilization as we know it. And that would be a terrible thing. Yeah. So you kids better straighten up and fly right, which is very much kind of a sensibility. Yeah. And again, like you, like the recurring motif in the show of like civilizations. And again, very 60s sensibility, civilizations where the kids have taken over and it's gone horribly, horribly, horribly wrong.
Right.
It's like, and the children shall lead is like a great and terrible example.
Yeah, Melvin Belly, the greatest Star Trek monster of all time. Yeah.
Played by Brian Cox. I just want, like, I'm really disappointed that Zodiac didn't, like, there's a scene in the extended cut where he talks about shooting it. And I'm kind of really disappointed that Fincher didn't, like, do a period recreation of Brian Cox in the costume.
Death but, like, to you all. Yeah, yeah.
Tell me that Brian Cox's career wasn't leading to that. But even say Miri as well, which is very much a similar allegory where it's like, geez, kids these days, am I right?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
But like that's why I think the Immunity Syndrome kind of works, because it avoids that, because you get a sense that like Sabarov actually kind of believes the stuff that he's writing, mm-hmm. instead of just finding it both interesting and terrifying as an old man. You mentioned that he did two episodes of The Next Generation. He wrote the script for Home Soil,
yeah.
which is transparently The Devil in the Dark, but with, you know, new characters and uniforms. Yeah. and he came up with a story for Conspiracy. But it's notable that like the ideas at the heart of the Immunity Syndrome bubble through those ideas that he wrote 20 years later. So like Home Soil, like the idea of the Immunity Syndrome is that the entire universe is connected, man, that we're all one big entity, that what if we're all part of like one big body, dude?
Yeah.
Like, and again, like you can mock it and it's laughable and it's kind of goofy and trippy in a 60s way, but you look at something like Home Soil and it's like, what if this planet was like all one big living thing, man? And it's like, yeah, okay, fine. I can see that Sabarov's buying into this. Or even Conspiracy, where like Conspiracy is, well, there's the aliens, which are a hive mind of themselves. Mm. But the idea that they're not possessing people, they're possessing the Federation and the human like species as an entity. They're like possessing the human kind of future and potential. It's like, okay, fine. I can see that you buy wholeheartedly into this idea that you're writing. Yeah. It doesn't feel like This Side of Paradise, where it's like, yeah, sure, kids are cool and those hippies will probably watch it, but we should probably make it clear that hippies are not cool, and that like they're going to lead to the downfall of civilization.
Yeah. It's interesting too that like, speaking of old men, like McCoy, the oldest guy on board, is the guy that's the most excited about it. He's like, I want to get out there and check that out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I actually really quite like about Star Trek, like, as overseen by Gene L. Coon, because I know that this is a transitional episode. It was commissioned by Coon and produced by John Lucas Meredith. But, like, one of the things that I really liked about Coon as a producer of Star Trek was this sense of him embracing youth. Like, it was Coon who introduced comedy to Star Trek. It was Coon who was like, maybe we don't have to take ourselves so seriously. You know, David Gerard doing, like, I, Mud, and then obviously The Trouble with Tribbles, which are, you know, I mean, The Trouble with Tribbles at least is regarded as a classic now, but which famously like brushed Roddenberry so far the wrong way that it reportedly contributed to the fact that Coon didn't stay on to the end of the second season.
Yeah.
But you look at that and you see a playfulness at it, and you see a kind of like a willingness to like try new things and to look at the universe a different way. Like, I think the original series as overseen by Coon is the highlight of the original series. I think it's the best that the show is.
Yeah.
I think a large part of that is down to the fact that like, you mentioned this old man shakes fist at cloud stuff, or this kind of like being written by World War II veterans. And I would argue that like, as much credit as Roddenberry deserves for creating Star Trek, he was very much that. Like, you look like Roddenberry's scripts, when you look at them, are very much old man has opinions on things. And you look at like, say, you know, the Omega Glory, which is just a mess of an episode, which is also horribly racist. Or you look at, say, Turnabout Intruder, and it's like, this is what Gene Roddenberry thinks social commentary is, about how women are too emotional to be in command. And it's like, well, okay, this is very much written by a man who was an adult in 1947. So yeah, we can go with that. And I think that like, and like, you look at how Roddenberry's scripts are like really preoccupied with structure and order and discipline and respect for authority. And again, like, obviously Roddenberry later on, particularly around, say, the motion picture era, would reinvent himself as this kind of like second generation flower child.
Yeah,
like, if you've read the novelization of the motion picture, it's all like free love all the time, baby.
Yeah.
Not to go too far down a tangent, but if you haven't read the novelization for the motion picture, there's like a moment where Kirk is like, well, which of one of us should seduce Elia? Sure, she has an emotional attachment to Decker, but let's face it, I'm the better lover here, right? it's amazing. Like, it is amazing to read. But like, at the time when the original Star Trek was being produced, Roddenberry was largely the force behind like the structure and the discipline and the listen to your elders and adhere to structure. So think of things like the last two scripts that he wrote for the show, like, say, The Savage Curtain, in which it's revealed that, and I love, this is one of those, I love it, but it's terrible, but I also love it so much, where it's revealed that the Enterprise has a protocol for welcoming on board Abraham Lincoln, the president of a country that has not existed at this point in time for hundreds of years. But Kirk is going to follow that protocol anyway. Or you look at, say, Turnabout Intruder, which is an episode that is nominally a body swap episode in which Kirk's body is stolen and hijacked by a woman who wants to take command to prove that she has what it takes, but which inexplicably becomes a court-martial episode, like, for the long middle stretch of it, because order and discipline and structure are very important things that we need to instill. And so, like, I kind of get the sense when we talk about Star Trek that, yes, there was that kind of moment you described of old men kind of shaking their fists and going, yeah, this is the way that things are meant to be. But I do also kind of, like, I think that you got people like, say, Kuhn, who were more experimental and more willing to kind of play and embrace new ideas and do things like, yeah, but man, what if we're part of, like, one giant organism? The organism is like the universe.
I was reading the TOS writer's guide the other day because I'm an oversexed rock star, and the last bit of the Q&A section has a question, you know, framed as like, you're a potential writer, you're asking us questions, and it's like, are you guys on LSD? And the reply is, we tried it, but we couldn't keep it lit. So clearly they were aware of things, but kind of also knew that they were a square, but also kind of hoped that maybe they weren't so square.
Yeah, and again, like, I think it's aged remarkably well in that sense, in that I think there is a lot of Star Trek. Like, it's telling that Spock was embraced as a counterculture icon.
Yeah.
And as a queer icon, and as, like, this breakout for, like, Star Trek fans and, like, Star Trek fandom to rally around. I think Kirk is your conventional kind of, like, straight leading man in a 60s TV show. And I love Kirk very, very much. I think Shatner is phenomenal. I think Shatner's performance style, you know, gets a lot of unfair flack. It is very heightened and very much in key with a lot of what the show is doing at certain points.
Oh, yeah.
But it's telling that, like, Spock was the breakout character, the guy with pointed ears like an elf because Tolkien was having a revival kind of in the 1960s. The guy who plays a harp, and the guy who went on to record, like, a spoken word in character song about how highly illogical all of this is. Like, again, I kind of love that it's that paradox you described of Star Trek being very terribly square, but also perhaps because it kind of, like, had an open mind, and also perhaps because it wasn't painfully trying, managing to somehow also be hip.
Yeah, I agree with that. I wanted to mention, too, McCoy. I love Kirk, I love Spock, everybody loves Spock, but I really started to love McCoy the older I got, and the more I began to, like, think about Trek, he's maybe the George Harrison of the group for me in that way. Yeah. And I think it's all down to DeForest Kelly's presence and talent as an actor, and also just the uniqueness of McCoy as a character. Like, who is this old guy, you know, running around with all these other people? And for a role that was recast twice through two pilots, without the actor even being top billed until the second year of the show, I think D. Kelly just really pulled that character in and pulled him up to be into that that trinity that we think of when we think of the main unit of TOS.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were talking a bit off mic before you started recording, and I think you mentioned that you've interviewed David or George, the third, for the podcast. And, like, I think of, like, his work with McCoy in that wonderful novel, because you asked that question, like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
Like, how exactly do you make sense of McCoy as a character based on what we learn from him, learn about him in the show over the course of it? Because we understand who Kirk is. He has this kind of lust for adventure. You know, he was very bookish in the original show, and then he became this kind of ladies' man in the third season into the films. Mm. We understand who Spock is because he's a child of two worlds and he's caught between these two extremes. And he has this kind of, like, reservoir of emotion, but underneath a kind of a stoic exterior. And McCoy, you're right. McCoy, as you get older, McCoy becomes much more interesting because he doesn't have that simple hook. Instead, he has this kind of, like, deadpan demeanor and this kind of, like, almost very kind of laissez-faire attitude to all the crazy stuff that the universe throws at him.
A
large part of it is down to Kelly's performance, which is really, really great. And I kind of, like, again, just to bring it back to David or George, it's Providence of Shadows is the story that I'm thinking of, the book that I'm thinking of. And I remember that is one of my favorite Star Trek tie-in novels because it does exactly what you're describing. It's like, how in the name of goodness do you make sense of who McCoy is? Because you look at him on screen and he's perfectly assured. He seems like there's no place in the universe that he belongs more than here. But then you think about him and it's like, but wait, what do we know about his life? What are the contradictions?
Yeah.
How is somebody like that, somebody who seems as grounded and down to earth and folksy as McCoy, also perhaps the like coolest member of the Enterprise crew.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of paradox of the character, which is so understated. And again, you know, it's telling that we mentioned the kind of feud that existed between Nimoy and Shatner. Kelly, by all accounts, was a perfect gent very laissez-faire and very happy to be there and very relaxed. And that really comes across. And I think, you know, you mentioned we've talked a lot about like the importance of the triptych. I think that aspect is very important as well, because you constantly have, and I think you can see it when you watch the episodes and even when you watch the films, you can see Shatner and Nimoy kind of like vying almost for kind of space. And Nimoy is very like stoic and dignified about it. And Shatner is sometimes very clear in what he's doing. But like, I think that if you didn't have DeForest Kelly as McCoy being there and being the kind of balance, being the guy who always seemed like he was happy to be there, who always seemed like he was willing to roll with the punches. And yeah. Like, we mentioned how surreal those punches are kind of earlier in this episode when we talked about, oh yeah, there's a salt vampire. It's like McCoy just takes this in his stride.
Right.
It's like, I remember like the Trouble at Tribbles, where McCoy, like, these things are taking over the ship and their biology makes no sense.
Yeah.
And McCoy is just thrilled.
Yeah, like, they're born pregnant and they're bisexual. Yeah.
I can't figure it out. And he's grinning. He's grinning ear to ear. That's the thing that I love about McCoy as a character, is that like he's, and that's the thing that you kind of miss. And I think you're right that when you point to attempts to recreate the kind of Trinity, because when you sum McCoy down, when people who maybe haven't registered that aspect of McCoy, that contradiction, kind of boil McCoy down to his essence, it's like, oh, he's the grumpy, folksy country doctor who's vaguely racist towards Spock. And, you know, he is that. Let's be entirely fair.
Yes.
But it's also vitally important that he is also the guy who's, like, thrilled to find that these furry, purring things are apparently reproducing fast enough that they will suffocate every living creature on the Enterprise. And the fact that he can't figure it out is amazing to him. And yeah. I think even here in the Immunity Syndrome, you have that at play as well, where it's like he wants to go on this mission, and it's very clear that he wants to go, not necessarily like, you know, he talks about Spock talks about the martyr complex that McCoy has. And I think the irony, I think that's a nice little subtle character work, because you have the suggestion that like Spock might actually have the martyr complex, because Spock is the character who in the opening scenes like has that 400 deaths as a result of this creature poured into his brain.
Sure.
And it's Spock who gives McCoy this kind of big speech about how, well, first of all, Vulcan's never been conquered, but also about the fact that like Vulcans understand the importance. It's a prototype of the needs of the many speech. It's like, well, you know, if humans understood the depth of 400 people's suffering, then maybe human history would be a lot less bloody. So you have the sense of like, maybe Spock's motivation here is that he wants to sacrifice himself to save the crew. He's making the big play here. He's being the hero.
Yeah.
And the irony of him then accusing McCoy of like having a martyr complex and saying that disqualifies him, despite the fact that like McCoy is more like, this is insane.
Whoa.
It's like, no, we haven't even begun to dig into this. Can we just hang around a little longer? I know the entire crew is like deflated like balloons.
Right.
I know that there are no stars out there. I know that we're all going to die. I know that it's probably going to consume the entire universe. But I just want to say, we haven't even done the groundwork here.
Yeah.
Come on, just give me a bit of time.
He's so, like you said before, he's so pleasant, and he was such a nice gentleman as an actor. And like when he brings that warmth to the screen, as this guy who was older, with presumably more experience and kind of the eternal observer, when he's happy, I'm not worried. You know, there's a lot of scary monsters on Star Trek, you know, when I was watching the original series as a kid, I was scared. But like, if McCoy was happy, I knew that things are probably okay. But when McCoy is freaked out, we're really in trouble. You know, but he's still a real cool hand, though. I love the scene in Space Seed where Khan, you know, ambushes him, puts a knife to his throat, and he's a second from death, but he's just like, hey, if you're going to do it, do it. But do it cleanly, though. You know what I mean? Like, he's looking at death, but he's not going to crack.
Also, I mean, somebody's going to have to clean this up when you're done. So
yeah, we'll have to have Chapel take care of that. I wanted to ask you here at the end of our show about your space dad. My space dad can beat up your space dad. Who's your favorite captain and why?
Sisko, easily. And I think that, I say easily, I mean, Picard is also up there. But Picard feels like an unrealistic space dad in terms of expectations.
Yeah.
In that I feel like if I had like Picard as my space dad and I went out into the real world, I would have like a shattering of expectations. Whereas Sisko, on the other hand, what I really like about Sisko is that he's very much hands off when it comes to his crew. He's very much the ideal like manager figure when it comes to managing his crew. He doesn't micromanage everybody. He doesn't hover over them. He doesn't necessarily like try to teach them all life lessons, although if they need them, like Ezri or Odo, he's happy to dispense them. He's quite happy to just be a boss who hangs out, as he does with Bashir, or like a boss who shares experiences of kind of, you know, wartime, as he does with O'Brien. And like I like that aspect of Sisko, just as a dude who's doing his job and who's, you know, not necessarily seen as being a surrogate father figure for the crew, because he is a literal father figure to Jake. And I kind of like, that's the thing that I kind of really admire about Sisko, is the fact that and again, I think it's probably something that I admire about Deep Space Nine as a whole, is the fact that like, you look at TOS and you look at TNG and you look at how integral Picard is to those. And even in episodes that don't feature like those characters, or aren't based around those characters heavily, there's always like a big Picard scene. There's always a moment where Picard injects himself in and tells you like what the right thing to do in this situation is. Even when Worf is involved in Klingon politics, don't worry, Picard is there to offer him good fatherly advice. Whereas the thing that I really like about Sisko, and again, to make him my space dad, is that it feels like he's there if you need him, but he's not there if you don't.
If you need to borrow the keys to the runabout, he's there.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And he might ask you where you're going, but he'll generally just tell you to have it back without any dents in it before midnight.
Yeah, right.
like that's my like favorite thing about Sisko. Like, there's the moment where like, I think it's compare like Worf when he's talking to Picard about things like, say, Gowron and Juros, and like his role in like the Klingon Empire going forward, and his need to kind of resign in order to like take part in the Klingon Civil War. And Picard's very much like, well, this is a rigid right way to do things, Mr. Worf, and if you're not going to do it that way, then we're going to have words and I'm going to be very disappointed in you. And then fast forward to like, I think it's when it rains and tacking into the wind, when like Worf is like, space dad Sisko, Gowron is kind of like ruining the whole war thing, and I think that we might need to do something about that. And Sisko, and it's one of the most remarkable scenes in Star Trek, because Sisko's just like, look, this is a problem, I need you to deal with it. There are going to be no follow-up questions.
Yeah.
Do we understand each other?
You have the solution.
You know what you need to do. Follow your heart, Mr. Worf. And I kind of like, that's the difference between Sisko and Picard in a nutshell. And that's probably why I would go with Sisko as my space dad, because I feel like he trusts me.
Yeah. I wonder how I would feel about Sisko if he, like Picard, had another four movies and an extra series of him doing pull-ups and having a phaser in each hand. And if Sisko had become the Sisko version of movie Picard, I wonder how I would feel. And Spencer for Hire doesn't count. He wasn't yet Sisko then.
Yeah. Like, I'm trying to wonder what the movie version of Sisko would look like. Because again, it's a really odd image to keep coming back to, but it's like Dramatis Personae, which is one of the first season episodes of Deep Space Nine. It's not necessarily a great episode of Deep Space Nine, but it's a great episode of Deep Space Nine, if you catch my meaning. But the moment where the crew are fighting each other, and like Sisko, I believe, wrestles a guy who comes at him with a phaser, throws him over into one of the pits in Ops, and then jumps himself into the pit on top of the dude. I feel like if you were to like take Sisko and like give him the equivalent level up to like movie Picard, I don't think my brain can visualize that.
It'd be a short movie.
Yeah.
Well, now that we've reached the end of the show, you'll receive a commission and the rank of ensign. What department on the ship do you work in?
I feel like, again, going back with TOS, I feel like I would be one of those people who has a really obscure speciality that doesn't necessarily mandate me being president.
20th
like,
century historian.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Something like that.
20th century pop culture historian.
That's so like, even worse.
Yeah, so I'm like sitting there watching sitcom episodes until accidentally, you know, sort of Kirk finds Norman Lear has been frozen cryogenically and we have to find a way to communicate with him. But no, I feel like, yeah, that's probably where my specialty would lie. I'd be the guy on the ship who's like, yeah, I'm pleasant. People get along with me. I do all my paperwork. But it's like, nobody's missing me at the big meetings. And nobody's like, we're about to take a mission down to this planet. There have been reports of soul vampires. We think that Ensign Mooney should report directly to the transporter room. I'm like, no. No, Ensign Mooney knows exactly where his place is. And this is not it. So I feel like, one of those insanely kind of specialized kind of fields would be it.
Man, at this point, Norman Lear is going to be around in the 24th century. still going.
It's still working. Like, he'll still be writing horror novels. Like,
yeah, he just cut another deal. Yeah.
I mean, I think you were joking a little while ago about, like, how Hollow Publishing works when it comes to, like, Voyager and author. That's the reason is because Norman Lear is still working for them. Like, you know, sure, the economics of the future are quite different, but when Norman Lear says he needs a publisher, you give Norman Lear a publisher.
Right, yeah. We got to get that out there. I also thought a 20th century pop figure historian would be interesting.
Oh, little Funkos, kind of like Funkos.
Yeah. Yeah. So as a scientist, you know the different, like, the composition of plastic would place this somewhere in the first decade of the 21st century.
Here's a question. How do Funkos work in a post-scarcity economy? I feel like that's another hour of podcast.
Everything's
we shouldn't
made
go
of
in
them.
There.
Yeah, that's how it works. Just like all
it's
of their
reconstituted.
Equipment.
Yeah, it's just reconstituted from Funkos. Them. Yeah.
Well, Anson Mooney, thanks for joining me to talk about Star Trek
and
the Star Trek universe. If people want to continue the conversation, and they can, at EIST Pod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
I'm at Darren_Mooney on Twitter. I'm at all the stuff that you mentioned earlier on very generously. So the movie blog with a zero instead of an O. I'm at The Escapist, where I write twice weekly in the frame and occasionally more than that when I have crazy ideas that I attack my editor with in the middle of the night. And you can also listen to me at The 250, which is available wherever good podcasts are not sold, and also where some not so good podcasts are also not sold. So you can find me online by just giving me a kind of a search there. But even if you type just Darren Mooney into a search bar, odds are I'm ubiquitous. It's either me or the drummer from Primal Scream.
Sure. And your books are still available through Amazon?
Yes, I should absolutely mention that. My publishers will be very, very happy. I've actually published two books, and a third one's in the works, which I'm not sure I can talk about at the moment.
Oh,
but the two books that I published, which I'm very, very proud of, are the Opening the X-Files, A Critical History of the Original Series, which kind of takes a look at the X-Files as a text as it unfolds in the 90s, and then Christopher Nolan, A Critical Study of the Films, which is a film-by-film account of the films of Christopher Nolan, which, again, I'm very, very proud of. And we look at, the kind of history of kind of like Nolan's interest in film, kind of the context in which those movies are released, because again, Nolan's films are interesting in an evolution of cinema. So those are all available. I mean, understandably, whether or not you want to order them from Amazon is your own call. You can order them online. They're available in ebooks. They're published by a wonderful press, McFarlane Press. So you can get them anywhere online, wherever you feel comfortable in doing so. So yeah, if you want to, go for it. Also, even to be honest, if you don't want to, because they are academic texts and they can be quite expensive, if you want to ask your local library to order them in for you, they have a whole budget for that, I've discovered.
And if you are interested in looking at them, I'll include links in the show notes for that as well.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show, and we're signing off. Until the next mission, Hailing Frequencies closed. Backtracking is back for an all-new season. Hi, I'm Caliban.
And I'm Gooey Fame.
And we'd like to introduce you to Backtracking, the podcast that explores the real-world inspirations behind your favorite episodes of Star Trek.
From historical events to classical literature to blockbuster films, we go where no pod has gone before to seek out the origins of classic Trek tales.
Did you know, Gooey, that the TNG episode Too Short a Season was an allegory for the Iran-Contra affair?
Yeah, only sweatier. Did you know that the Enterprise episode Regeneration was an homage to the John Carpenter film The Thing?
Archer and T'Pol freezing to death over a bottle of whiskey would have been a controversial ending.
As a dog lover, Archer would not like The Thing, I'm guessing.
Oh my god, movie night is canceled. Join us every other Thursday for a journey back to the beginnings of the Trek universe.
Backtracking is available wherever you get your podcasts.
No, Porthos!